Welcome, listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. That's in the Black Belt, and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. And that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media is there. Full of podcasts of the latest programs on Time for Awakening, and always interesting articles that you can download, read, or listen at later times, or even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's Sunday night, 7:08 in the city of Philadelphia, and we'll be open for him for a little bit. We've got a special guest joining us around the 8 o'clock hour. Professor Akil Parker will be joining us to discuss some topics pertinent to the African-American community and especially our youth. But before we bring our guests on around 8 o'clock hour sometime, the phones will be open. So we'll be in open form, and possibly after our guest leaves, we might extend it a little bit. We'll see how things go. But we'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215 215- 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard. Is with us, Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Things worked out well for me and I this weekend so far, so that was good.
Yeah, I know that you had been moving around, attending some meetings this week. I went over there to a organizational meeting on Wednesday. Political organizational meeting, and it was very interesting what transpired. Just another meeting scheduled for 2 weeks from now with some of the same agenda points that we were dealing with. So I think something's going to come out of this, Richard. I'll kind of expand on it after some certain things are nailed down, but I think something's going to come out of this one way or the other. Some movement is coming out of this.
Yeah, it's, this week, you know, whole midterm election piece, I hope that we Africans and, you know, and Black people in general understand, you know, like what is required in order to, really secure ourselves in this moment. I think a lot of things revealed itself. Not things that we didn't know, but a lot of things revealed itself in relationship to the muck and the mire that we're, you know, well, find ourselves in.
I don't know, Richard. You saying, you know, certain things we already knew. I don't know whether everybody realized what has revealed itself. I mean, maybe you might want to touch on some of the things, because I'm a definitely, you know, point out some things. But I don't know.
I mean, for one is, I mean, one of the things that the media projects, I guess if we say on the black side of the chessboard, it would be about the thing about voter suppression, right? On the white side of the chessboard, it would be about how white women, you know, have no compulsion to support their white men in their political relationship, or the power relationship that we characterize now and is being commonly thrown to us as the system of white supremacy, regardless of the other white women saying, me too. So those are just like two things now. Did we know that? My characterization, did we know that Miss Ann is going to support her husband, her boyfriend, her son, you know, and her children?
I don't. Well, that's the question, Richard. I don't think a percentage. I'm not going to say most of our people. A percentage of our people didn't think that way. They thought that because it's a Me Too. Excuse me. They thought because it's a Me Too movement and white women has been trying to build or act like they're building alliances with black women, feminists, and things of that nature, that you know, that they were all in this together. But white women showed that when they went behind that booth and pulled that curtain, they wasn't going to vote for black candidates. I don't care whether the black candidate didn't have a black agenda at all. They still wasn't going to pull a lever for a black candidate. And the numbers bared it out.
Hmm. Well, that's, just to put a twist on what you're saying, either not vote for a black candidate, or they'll always vote for a white, or maybe say their interests, which is the white candidate.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely.
Regardless, you know, and now if you're saying that, I don't know how, and I'll accept being, you know, naive. I don't know how in this day and time that black people, who are a large percentage of black people, don't know. Okay. Unless you're an ostrich, and even if you ain't going to go back 50 or 60 years, even if you're going to go back in the last 20 years or the last 10 years, I don't know how they can think that. Matter of fact, Elliot, I was thinking about is what's that black the movie Black Klansman, and for the listening audience, and if you've seen it, there's a piece about this guy who was a starch Klan member, him and his wife, and his wife was, you know, wanting to show the support for the cause. She even in the film went and took the bomb to try to bomb the young college student's house, because she wanted to be to show she was bought into, enrolled into what her husband was doing and what the cause was about. And for our historical knowledge, that's always been so. So I you know, that's why I must be naive, because I just can't see how we miss it.
You know, according to those numbers, Richard, those midterm numbers that came out, and this is according to a published report by Pew Research, that in this last midterm election, 47% of white men voted Democratic, 51% of white men voted Republican. In that same demographic, hold on a second. I got this a little mixed up here. Yeah, I'm sorry. That same demographic, black men or black people voted 90% for Democratic candidate, and 9% of black people, according to this Pew Research, voted Republican. Now, among the white men, 60% of white men voted Republican, 39% voted Democratic, and among white women, 49% voted Democratic, and 49% voted for Republican. So, according to the numbers, being that black women and men overwhelmingly voted for the candidates, Democrats, and voted for the three that were up, Gilliam, Stacey Abrams, and Presley, that means that they knew that white men wasn't going to vote for them, so they needed their so-called allies of white women to put them over the hump. And black women put their foot in black people's humps because they showed them that when they went behind the curtain, they wasn't going to pull the lever for those candidates. And the numbers show it. The raw numbers show it.
Yeah. And it's been consistent. You know, the statistic I seen in one article today did another breakout. And, you know, I think these models that they give us, you know, whether how much we put into it, we still need to be clear about it in relationship to our own interests. Because they were saying it was mostly the urban and suburban. The urban black, quote unquote, blacks and minority, other ethnic minorities, and the suburban white women, college educated white women, versus the rural, other working class white men and women in rural areas and that actually came out and voted Republican. So urban, urban black male and females in urban centers, and that's all up and down the East Coast, all through the South, through to Texas. But the Republican working white males and females all through the Midwest, up and down the Midwest. The thing that got me, if I'm projecting this correctly, Elliot, now, what is the political interest of white, educated, suburban women compared to lower working class and poor urban population? And you gave the general numbers of 90% of black people came out and voted for the Democratic Party. Yeah. My question is, do they have the same interests? Even though they voted Democrat, do they have the same interests? The same needs, let's say it that way.
Well, no, they're definitely not the same needs. But, you know, going inside the numbers, according to this Pew Research, blacks, men and women, voted 90% for Democratic candidate. But when they broke it down, the comparable shares was black men 88% and black women 92%, which put it basically at 90%. So to me, that's basically even numbers.
Right.
That supported Democrats. So they needed the so-called white women as an ally to put some of these candidates over the hump, and they didn't get it. But wait a minute. And that's what has me scratching my head, because I turned to some of these black terrestrial shows, and they were praising a lot of it because they had record numbers of women, white women, that won seats. So the white women came out and voted for white women, but they didn't vote for black folks, men or women. So they did support white women.
Oh, yeah.
They went into these seats. So, you know, here we go with the same old dog and pony show. The blacks, or your ancestors died for that right. They died so you could do that. And it's the same soup. Warmed over. It ain't even warmed over. It's the same old soup. We find ourselves in the same situation. And the same old stuff being told to our people after it's over.
And the reason why I bring up the difference of interests, you know, I mean, because now they're saying at least because the Democrats won the Congress and therefore the seats of these committees. So I'm hearing that they're going to have five out of the Congressional Black Caucus. They'll have five members that will hold seats in these committees. And I'm asking myself, okay, you know, what are they going to have in control of these seats, that being in leadership of these seats? How does that translate into resources within our community? And more importantly, to your point about what the meeting that you went to this week, you know, I'm still asking the question, do we have agendas in our community that we're gauging this 90% participation in the Democratic Party to say in relationship to outcome? It's no sense going to the store and you ain't got no money in your pocket.
Yeah,
or going to the store and you don't have a shopping list.
And that's why why we need to change our whole philosophy in regards to this voting, Richard. When Zaki Baruti and Omar Ali Ezotelli talked about proportional representation, that's got to be the way to go. You can't focus in on these national elections where black folks got to try to appeal to white voters to get in office, because then they lose their mind. Just like the brother Jerome Fox, addicted to, well, they're addicted to white. So everything black, that they don't want no association with it. If they got to appeal to white voters, all that goes out the window. We just got to, we got to revamp how we're dealing with this. And in certain areas of the country, black folks have revamped how they're dealing with this. The information just got to get out to other people, to other black people, the way we have to deal with this. And it's nothing new. Malcolm said it over 50 years ago. And I want to share something with two things I want to share with the listening audience. And I'm quite sure you're aware of, Richard, and probably a lot of our listening audience, what W.E.B. Du Bois said in 1956. I'm going to read that, just a portion of that, to the listening audience again, because it's kind of strange, Richard, that it's not strange. What he's saying in 1956 is the same thing going on now. But let me read this. You know, I read those numbers about Pew Research. Let me read this article, just a portion of the article that you sent me, Richard. It's entitled, "Will White Women Voters Ever Be Who We Want Them to Be?" That's the question this reporter asks. Now I'm going to read a couple paragraphs. It says, it's become something of a bleak election night ritual, assessing the exit polls and seeing that white women voters overwhelmingly threw their support behind conservative Republican male candidates. Again, they did it for Donald Trump, who won an estimated 53% of the white female vote in 2016. They did it with Roy Moore, accused of sexually predatory behavior in Alabama's special Senate election last year. And while there were many thrilling historic wins for progressive women, in particular in 2018 midterm, the data showing that white women are appealing, some white women are appealing away from Donald Trump, white women overwhelmingly rendered another disappointment. The latest gut punch, courtesy of CNN polling, in the Georgia gubernatorial race, an estimated 75% of white women, even more than white men. Now, let me read that again. Because Oprah and everybody else was ringing on doorbells. Oprah's supposed to be appealing to white folks. Let me read that again. The latest gut punch, courtesy of CNN polling, in Georgia governor's race, an estimated 75% of white women, even more than white men, voted for Republican Brian Kemp, who is passionately pro-life, over Stacey Abrams, a staunch protector of women's reproductive rights, while 97% of black women supported her. So 75% of white women voted for the Republican, and of 97%, it said black women, but over 90% of black men and women. I don't like to be differentiating when it comes to black people. These white folks love to do that. But over 90% of black people voted for Abrams. And you see where the knockout blow came from.
And still, you know, for Georgia, from what I understand.
Oh, wait a minute. Let me finish this out, Richard. I just seen this at the bottom. The numbers are similar in the Florida's governor's race, where 51% of white women voted for Ron DeSantis instead of Andrew Gillum, who wanted to protect no-cause birth control in the state. But more black women, 82%, chose Gillum. So again, the overwhelming majority of white women voted against Gillum. Even though these candidates, Richard, don't have a black agenda. They're just a black face. So they don't give a darn whether you got a black agenda or just a black face. They're not pulling the lever for you.
That's why I mean, like, and because I really believe, and that's where the proportional representation comes in, believe that that edict that all politics is local, that what we have to do is be able to create this, not now, since this voting thing is over, to get out the vote. Amongst black people, we need to be creating the coalition or confederation amongst ourselves, because it just seems that we need to be able to, you know, create the infrastructure so that we can be able to, as we were talking about, we talk about all the time, define our platform, define our issues, develop our candidates, and then utilize that vote then, not as a be-all and end-all, but as one tool to hold off this onslaught of what these, in this case, now they gave us the white women as the boogeyman. See, before it was the white man that was the boogeyman. First it was just white people, right? I mean, we just said it was white people, right? Then it was saying, well, white men. Now they done gave us the boogeyman is the white woman. And, you know, and just because you're Democrat, I mean, unless, and maybe in the listening audience or maybe other places, because I haven't seen that flushed out. What is it? I mean, if we're talking about politics, it's about resources and it's about, you know, scarce resources being shared around, but it's being in relationship to your interests and your power ability. So if white women are educated, live in the suburbs, and they're and some of them are young and dealing with, what is it that they can be interest for those resources compared to black men and women and children who the housing from gentrification, the education, and school system needs to be the infrastructure, the building infrastructure, plus the curriculum itself needs to be revamped. The health issues that we have in our community, the, you know, the job issues. What is those, I mean, what at the federal level could these elected officials actually do to satisfy both groups? And who is more politically organized?
Yeah, well, I mean, we know that they are, to a certain extent, more politically organized than a lot of our people, and especially in these urban areas. But that's not saying that we can't do it. We can do anything we want to do. In fact, we are organized in these areas to support the Democratic Party. They don't even have to spend money in these urban areas, Richard. And the people come out. They don't even have to spend money and they come out.
Right.
Let me share, read this again. And this is a reflection of W.E.B. Du Bois. His life, and you know, the thing about W.E.B. Du Bois is different from a lot of the other men during our history here in this country, is that his life went full circle. The man lived to be almost 100 years old. So, I mean, he almost had done and seen everything, if you want to put it in that frame or fashion. But let me read what he says, and this is a reflection of over 60 years of him voting. And it's entitled, his writing is entitled, Why I Won't Vote. And I'm going to just take a paragraph or two. It says, since I was 21 in 1889, I had a theory and followed the voting plan strongly in the nation on August 4th, voting for a third party, even when its chances were hopeless. If the main parties were unsatisfactory or in the absence of a third choice, voting for the lesser of two evils, my actions, however, had to be limited by the candidates' attitudes towards Negroes. Of my adult life, I spent 23 years living and teaching in the South, where my voting choice was not asked. I was disenfranchised by law or administration. In the North, I lived for 32 years, covering 8 presidential elections. In 1912, I wanted to support Theodore Roosevelt, but his Bull Moose Convention dodged the Negro problem, and I tried to help elect Wilson as a liberal Southerner. Under Wilson came the worst attempt at Jim Crow legislation and discrimination in the civil service that we have ever experienced since the Civil War. Hold on 1 second. In 1916, I took Hughes as the lesser of two evils. He promised Negroes nothing and kept his word. In 1920, I supported Harding because of his promise to liberate Haiti. In 1924, I voted for LaFontaine, although I knew he could not be elected. In 1928, Negroes faced an absolute dilemma. Neither Hoover nor Smith wanted the Negro vote. Both publicly insulted black Negroes. I voted for Thurman Thomas. He was a socialist, although the socialists had attempted to Jim Crow Negro members in the South. In 1932, I voted for Franklin Roosevelt, since Hoover was unthinkable and Roosevelt's attitude towards workers seemed more realistic. I was again in the South from 1934 to 44. Technically, I could vote, but the election in which I could vote for was a farce. Retired for age in 1944, I returned to the North and found a party to my liking. In 1948, I voted for the progressive ticket for Henry Wallace, and in 52 for Vincent Hanlon. In 1956, I will not go to the polls. I have not registered to vote. I believe that democracy has so far disappeared in the United States that it has no two evils exist, but there is one evil. There is one evil party with two names. So that's what W.B. Du Bois said in his reflections of over 50 or 60 years of voting. If you put it in layman's terms, and we've talked about it before, he was on the treadmill and his feet was moving, but our folks didn't go anywhere. Some candidates he said he voted for would promise black folks they was going to do something and did nothing. Others didn't promise them anything. White folks haven't changed their game plan when it comes to black people and voting, because they figure that you ain't got nowhere else to go, especially the Democratic Party. The Republicans, they don't give a darn about you, call you all kind of names, call you everything but the N-word, because they know, that's their checks and balances. They want people to participate, and they wanted to participate in that fashion. That makes it work. Every 4 to 8 years, and especially they don't mind it, doubling up, but they want things to change over after every 8 years. They want the House to flip over, the Senate to flip over. That's how things work. It works right when it does that.
Yeah, that's why I find myself more and more, Elliot, being this advocate you know, because I've always thought that we have to look internally and we have to organize internally. And that, you know, for those who are participating, and they still now they already then geared them up for 2020, right? So, you know, and it's still shifting now, you know, again, from what are the resources that we can get out of that 80%? Because remember, the question came about the, whether after that 90, almost 95, oh, what it was 95, 90, in the 90% that voted for Obama, you know, when we did the postmortem and we asked, what did Black people give for this two times giving, voting and giving 90% at that level of office in relationship to our community? Now, some people, I keep hearing the general, nothing, but it must, you know, here we go again. And until we can be able to come up with clear, identifiable wins, you know, other than that the person got the office, the person got the committee chair, you know, and we have to, you know, unless we can come up with clear, identifiable wins, what is it that we have? And that's why I'm, you know, being this advocate for, until we can be able to create the, and I'm calling it, I'm calling it a, based off of what I'm hearing, and I'm accepting a confederation amongst ourselves. Because for those who are Democrats or Republicans or nationalists or Pan-Africanists or who have issues like reparations or who have issues like healthcare or education, if we don't sit down at the table and come up with the agenda and a policy and the plan to accomplish that, then we'll always be spinning our wheels amongst other people who are definitely going to that trough, whether it's at deficit or at surplus, and walking away with something.
With something, exactly. You're exactly right. And we don't.
It's just simple to me as that.
Richard, let me say something. Now, here in Pennsylvania was another one of those heated races for governor. Two white candidates. Wolf, who was the, I guess you call it the incumbent, the one that's in office.
Right.
And the challenger, this guy Wagner, they used a Willie Horton style thing there about they threw Mumia's name all in it. Did you see some of those ads?
Yeah.
It was Willie Horton style politics, if you want to use that term. Now, this guy Wolf won the election based off of Pittsburgh and Philadelphia's support. It wasn't a blue wave in Pennsylvania. It was a black wave. Black folks put that guy in. Now, he didn't spend hardly any money in the black community. But black folks put him in over the Republican. Now, the House and Senate here in Pennsylvania is Republican.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to play this because it was on a terrestrial station here in Philadelphia. Black station. I want to play his words. Listen to his words, if it's out of his own mouth, in regards to what he's going to do for black people, being that they gave him those votes. Listen to it and tell me what you think, whether it's insulting, whether it's bullshit. Listen to what he said, and excuse expression if I offended anybody. Listen to this clown that just won here in Pennsylvania. Let me play this clip, if I can get it.
We can move even faster and hopefully do a lot more.
What would a second term of Tom Wolf mean for the African-American community, not just in Philadelphia, but throughout the state?
Well, again, under the assumption that I'm going to get a little more help in the General Assembly, we can actually do more in criminal justice reform, bail bond reform. We have clean slate legislation that expunges misdemeanors, nonviolent misdemeanors from a person's criminal record. But we need to add felonies to that, nonviolent felonies. We need to move faster on that. We need to have a cap on probation. Pennsylvania is one of a handful of states that doesn't have a cap on the number of years you can be in probation. So this is technically or theoretically, you can be in probation forever. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Again, I mentioned the bail reform. We need to change our sentencing guidelines and get out get away from mandatory minimum sentences. We need to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana. So those are important things. In terms of schools, there are so many kids who grow up at a disadvantage because their schools haven't been adequately funded. Their teachers don't have the resources. We need to stop that. So,
final question to you, Governor Wolf.
We can move even.
Okay, let me stop it, Richard, because then he went on to something else. Did you hear what this guy said? Now, he said, well, if I can, now notice he couched it when he said, if I can get help from the legislature. Now, the legislature is Republican. He won the second term because blacks in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia put him in office. Now, he said, if I can get help from the legislature, I'll work on criminal justice reform and I'll work on sentencing guidelines and probation, dealing with probation, and legalizing small amounts of marijuana. Now, wait a minute, Richard. We know that this criminal justice system stinks, and this whole thing needs to be torn apart, this whole system that we live under. But the majority of black people that voted for him, in fact, the black folks that voted for him weren't felons, because in Pennsylvania, if you got a felony, you can't vote. So what is he talking about? The people that voted for him wasn't in jail. They're not on probation. I'm not in jail. Neither are you. You don't want to smoke weed. I don't want to smoke no weed. Is that, that's what he thinks about the people that voted for him, black people, that they in jail or about to go to jail or want to smoke weed? That answer he gave that black reporter was insulting. And for him not to fire back at him I just can't. Some of these people with mics and all, they call themselves black, they're a disgrace. All that construction going on in both Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, you go on these construction sites, ain't no blacks working. The gentrification that's rampant in both Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. He gives some old BS about people are failing in schools. We need to do better. Come on, man, with that weak stuff. The schools is being closed in Philadelphia and given over to developers. Gentrification is off the charts. He's not talking about any business development in these communities or business startups. All he talked about is change some sentencing guidelines, change probation, and legalize marijuana. That's if he can do it, if he gets legislature. Help from the legislature. If you don't get no help from the legislature, then you just lose out. Come on, man. We can't be accepting this foolishness. And black people voted for this clown, and he gets in there and shows him, he gives him his butt to kiss. Let me grab a couple calls. Maybe we can before Brother Keel joins the conversation. Let's go to Newport News. I think this is the line here. Let's go to
Good
Newport.
Good evening, my comrades.
How are you, sir?
You gentlemen pretty much covered it.
I think we got, because we're getting a little echo. Maybe you're on this side.
What about now?
Good. We're good.
Okay, I'm sorry. I tried to.
No, you're all right.
Listen in on the phone and then switch over from the computer. Look, I'm going to ease into this. Like this. I'm from the South. I've learned that if you really want to know what a black person is all about, don't invest any faith in them until you see how they conduct themselves around or to white people. And I'm going to give you a quick story, then I'm going to try to answer some of the issues you got. I listened to a podcast for about a year now. And the host is really nasty when you call in and try to interrogate him about this loyalty to the Democrats. But what you gonna do? I'm tired of the lesser two evils. They should have been Hillary and all that. So you really can't have the kind of intelligent conversations like you guys are having and saying, you still got to make demands on these people. And he, and one of the favorite things he uses is the whataboutism. So last night when I listened to him, I listened to him for about 22 minutes, let a little white boy from Arkansas call in and spit a lot of numbers about what was wrong with the ACA and all these cities in the U.S. that's run by Democrats and all that. And don't you know, this Negro went back and forth with him. So I got up this morning after careful consideration, and I sent him a little note and told him basically what I started with here. As a black man in the South, I've learned you really don't know what kind of Negro you're dealing with until you see how he conducts himself rightfully. So you never have to worry about me tuning in again. I've had about all I can take tap dancing, buck dancing people, just like the Roland Martins and the Tom Joyners. Everything about our life is a joke or criminal justice and what's wrong with us. We don't know how to talk about anything about the quality of life, just like you pointed out with that black journalist that interviewed that governor. If you're not willing to confront people when they insult you,
I know it,
because they're nice about it or they use etiquette, there's something wrong with you. I don't even fault the white man. I don't fault him. Because just like you said, when he went through the things that he was going to work on, and started it almost just like the 13th Amendment with an exception clause.
Exactly.
If I can work with the legislature. Shit, you just pointed out. Ain't nobody in the legislature in your party, so what's the likelihood of that?
Man, I'm telling you, I just couldn't believe this journalist. And I don't really know him. I've seen him around because he's in Philadelphia. You know, how you stand in and accept it. I just can't see how you can accept that answer from this guy. He must have looked at this white guy, must have looked at him like, I'll tell this guy this N-word anything, and he's not going to challenge it. You let that man just tell you some old gobbledygook like he did, and you didn't even, that's insulting. What he said to him was insulting.
Good. As a representative of black people, it was insulting to the entire race, as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly.
Because what really gets me is that journalist got a degree and gone through all the things that the white man had told him he needed to do to be able to hold that mic. But his allegiance is not to his people. And I have the same problem with Roland Martin. As much as I like Eddie Cloud, I have the same problem with him. See, when you want to take everything about us and couch it to the white man to make it acceptable, rather than making demands just like Jews, just like the Mexicans, just like the Indians. Why I got to pretend that race is not an issue when race has been the issue since the day you brought me to the shores? You're making me play a mind game on myself.
I know.
So you never have to address anything. That is insulting to me.
Uh-oh.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to tell you, this gentleman had the nerve, after I sent him a message around 8, about 10:30, he comes back with a question. Would I like to elaborate? So I wrote back. You know, I try to show people respect. I said, why would I do that? H-E-double-L? No. Because all you'll do is deflect. If the owner of your station tried to send you messages in live chat to say, and this is what the woman said, this is not Stump the Host night. You need to move on from this. That was about 5 minutes into his conversation with the white boy. But he was so enthralled with having some 25, 26-year-old white boy from Arkansas explain to him why Democrats is causing the cost of living to be so high in San Diego. And I'm saying, there's not even any logic to your conversation. But you'll engage a white man and be all nice to him when somebody black brings up issues about why should you have loyalty to the Democrats. You'll call them all outside their name, how ignorant they are. So that's typical of our people. You will readily attack a supposed to be what comrade, fellow black person. But when it comes to that white man, you lay down your sword and amass it. How can I make you happy? Talk long as you want to. I've had all I can take of this, man. I'm too old to even try to pretend that something is like that. As a matter of fact, I appreciate if you send me that reporter's name, because I'll find the clip and I'll do the same thing to him I do to Soledad O'Brien. Then. Don't you dare come on Twitter talking about Jews and you ain't said nothing about the two black people got their brains blown out in the Kroger. And not worse, not only that, not only got their brains blown out, white America was exposed in that act better than anything you could see on, what, NCI, Vegas, or whatever. A white man armed, standing in that grocery store, witnessed a white man walk up and execute two fellow citizens. And when he pulled his gun out, they had enough respect for each other, they had a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
White folks don't kill white folks. What else do you need to know about America?
And that wasn't played up.
And he let him go, Brother Otis.
Yeah, what did I tell you? They had a gentlemanlike conversation. That shows you the power of identity politics and who is important in their lives. Now, what gets me is, I'm going to tie it into some other people. I ain't heard John Lewis, Clyburn, Maxine, none of them come out and ask, what happened to armed citizens protecting other innocent citizens? But they running around telling me about DACA. I don't understand it. All of them need to be called out. The best thing black folk can do is don't vote for none of them in 2020. And then they're going to get the message. If you want my vote, you got to make some kind of solid commitment to me. I'm going to run you one more. Talking about Stacey Abrams and Gillum. If you look at their track record, Stacey Abrams, I know you got what you got. She might win. But if you look at her, all of her money comes from fracking people in Georgia. I told you, it would take me a little time to figure it out. But when she was running the minority as minority whip in Georgia, she got all her money from big corporations. Fracking, private prisons, the whole bit. So she ain't even what people are claiming she is. And as far as white women, I love this Facebook timeline and Twitter. It's a digital record. When people start bringing out these charts, I go, oh, hold on. Let's go back to 2016. I'll even put up some of the insults people were giving me in 2015 when I was telling them what was going to happen. I don't care about them posters. We are 13% of the population. Only half of us are eligible to vote. That means we comprise 6%. It matters if you vote in your local area where politics is direct, your trash gets picked up, your taxes stay low, your roads are fixed, your school board, all of that matters. But if you're crazy enough to try to tell me with the way the Senate works and the Electoral College works, that barely 7% of the population is going to make a difference in a national election. I'm going to tell you this. Ain't no white folks since LBJ ever voted over 46 or 47% for Democrats when you do that demographic. So the rest of that crap with male, female, all that, don't matter one bit. And if they voting at 46 or 47%, and you ain't but 6% of the population, you have to be proportionately dispersed throughout 50 states to be able to flip anything. I'm going to leave it at that, gentlemen. But watch them Negroes. Don't have no allegiance to them until you see how they act around white folks. I'm going to leave you with that.
Thank you for your contribution, Brother Otis.
And I believe wholeheartedly in what you're saying. You know, and it's just I mean, this is why we have to be, as you say all the time, Elliot, very strategic. And I hear other, you know, Brother Otis brought up, you know, the statistical, and around me, people bring up the statistical numbers all the time. And about us being 13%, and I'm glad that of the population in general, and when you cut that in half, you know, what that will be. And so it's important for us to be more organized. That's what I guess the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, you know, we're going to transition over and get pick up Brother Professor Keel Parker into the conversation. I'm going to put him on hold briefly, and we take one more of these calls before we take a break and then have him get on.
Brother Elliot.
Uh-huh.
Can I throw in one other thing?
Yes.
Please, for the sake of the rest of the conversation, can you read that statement I put in the chat for you on exactly what Bernie Sanders said when he made a statement? I actually had black people explain to me how they could understand what Bernie said. If you read what he said about white people being uncomfortable voting for somebody black first, I told them they must have amnesia. I'm 65. I remember America voted for a black president. Plus, they had black people in Georgia, Alabama, and everywhere in local and state government. How in the world can this man that you're telling me I need to vote in this president, how can he make a statement? I think you know there are a lot of white folks out there who are not necessarily racist, but felt uncomfortable for the first time in their lives about whether or not they wanted to vote for African Americans. I think next time around, by the way, it would be a lot easier. Anybody that don't understand, he ain't no different than the white man Stanley Kroger and said, white folks don't shoot white folks.
Exactly.
I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you.
And we don't have to repeat it because you made it clear.
Let's grab 267.
Hey, good evening, Ellie, and good evening, Richard.
How are you?
You know, I just called, and I'm a backup brother, Otis, man. I had made a statement on another program about the main thing that's killing our folks as a people is lack of a code of ethics. And you had a guy that calls himself conscious started screaming me down. Now, one thing about that, you know, they told me if you take a rock, you throw it to a herd of swine, the one you hit is going to squeal the loudest. And, you know, anybody that thinks that our people, now I just heard Brother Otis, he's actually talking about the same thing that we talk about. We want our people to get better. And the thing about it, man, you read a code of ethics about a few months ago. Anybody that heard that program realizes what is hurting us as a people is a code of ethics. We have all these people like Roland Martin, Joe Madison, Al Sharpton, telling our people to go out and vote because our people died for the lack of, you know, our people died for the right to vote. But that's a big lie, and we need to keep them in check that that's a big lie. Our people were murdered trying to obtain some justice and some freedom. They didn't just go die to pull a lever. That's very insulting. We got to stop that nonsense when we hear it. Put these people in their place and let them know, no, our people were murdered. Some of them were murdered not even trying to pull the lever. Some of them were murdered just walking down the street. Some of them were murdered so-called by a woman lying, saying a little boy whistled at her. So don't let them get away with that foolishness. Now, the thing about it, Elliot, and Richard, maybe I'm coming from a different something I'm missing, because obviously this brother was very hostile and angry at me. And I told him, I said, man, I'll fly down Atlanta and talk to you man to man, because I'll be damned if I go across YouTube like some female back and forth or through a phone conversation. I'm a man. I don't operate like that. Shouting somebody down across the phone. Any punk can do that. And I'm still sort of angry about that. You know, you want people to hear your views, but if somebody else say a view that you disagree with, you're going to holler and scream at somebody like, you know, like you're some kind of sorry, you know. But I want to apologize to that brother, because maybe he is shooting for the same aim, you know, the same goals that I'm shooting for. But, you know, that stuff really disturbed me. And that's the problem, Ellie. If we get to the root cause of what our problem is, our people go haywire. They don't want to hear it. They just want to go there and say, Trump, 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 Trump is the problem. But Trump ain't the problem. It's the people that voted for him. You know what I mean? The Democrats ain't the problem. It's the people that vote for them. So if we had a code of ethics, some kind of agenda that comes from the grassroots up, to let them, because they already know what we need. We need our own land. We need the reparations that we were promised, the 40 acres and a mule with interest. We need all that, man. But we have nobody. We have these spokespeople that they put there in the middle, brainwashing the fools that want to shout down other people because we said, well, I don't know if I really want to vote because give me a reason why I should vote, why I should waste my gas money to go there and pull a lever. Well, we can gain both houses. And, you know, and I won't even say we, because I never heard these people put us on their agenda. I did hear Hillary talk about the mothers of the movement, which was embarrassing. That was very embarrassing, the mothers of the movement. You know, so, you know, man, I just called in to get some stuff off my chest. And, you know, they talk about, our, you know, if you don't vote, then you're a disgrace to our race. I think you're a disgrace to our race when you use our ancestors so you can get a television show or a better radio program that the enemy will pay you for to keep our people brainwashed. You're a disgrace to our race. So we need to challenge these people, man. And furthermore, I do not demonize our people. I love our people. And if I didn't love our people, I wouldn't want our people to get better. So any fool out there that thinks that our people have a code of ethics that we don't need to get better, you know, tell them, man, you know, I'm still sort of hot about that, but I'm just going to, like, take a chill pill because, you know, I'm just going to take a chill pill. I'm going to finish listening to the rest of the show. But even the Alton Maddox said the main thing that hurts us the most is a lack of ethics.
Yeah.
You could give us reparations, and what will we do with it? You know what I mean? So, you know, I'm going to listen to the rest of the show. I just had to get that off my chest, man. And I some of these people that call themselves conscious, man, I wish they stopped using that word. I wish they stopped using it. You know what I mean? Because like I said, I'm a grown man, and I sent word to them. I'll fly down there and meet you man to man. You know what I mean? You know, because I'm not going to holler over the phone like some punk. So I'm going to sit back. I'm going to listen to the rest of the program, man, and I'm going to take a chill pill. All right?
Thank you for your call, brother.
All right, man.
Peace. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll add Professor Akil Parker to the conversation. And you can join the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Time for Awakening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I trust transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me have held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be wrecked, if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
Not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
Mm.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you've called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we are black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House, you can even put him in his, he's going to still be a Tom. You can put them anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Encourage, let me just say this before our time winds up. And that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lauren Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back. It's a time for an awakening, and it's 8:19 in the city of Philadelphia. You can get involved in the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. 32, joining the conversation now, and he's been on the program before. It's Professor Akil Parker. Understand now, Professor Parker is at St. Joe University, Richard?
LaSalle?
Okay. Mm-hmm. And also the PASSEP, teaching at PASSEP, and he's been active in the community Philadelphia area now for quite a while, even though Professor Keel is a young man. Happy to have him back with us. Let's get him involved in the conversation. Professor Parker, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Good evening.
What's up there now?
Glad to have you with us.
Good, good, good.
Professor Parker, you know, you mentioned to me that some of the projects that you're working on, and
right.
And you sent the information. I kind of might want to work a little backwards here, based on some of the conversation that we've been having tonight.
Okay.
The third thing that you mentioned was a methodology developing for political education of our youth, termed geographic exemplar replacement.
Right.
And then you mentioned about the serious analysis of rap music lyrics and their political gravity. And then the other thing about teaching math education for our children and its implications. Let's work backwards here, being that we're in the season of this political environment or midterm and results and the implications on the African-American community. Talk about the methodology for the youth, the geographic exemplar replacement. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, geographic exemplar replacement. This is something that I kind of just, it builds on the work of a lot of other African-centered scholars that I've studied. Dr. Greg Carr, I read some of his work that he did around just around the concept of exemplars and intellectual genealogy and whatnot. And, as a classroom teacher, as a high school classroom teacher, just thinking about, in terms of my own personal development as an educator, the examples of teachers, or of scholar activists or of revolutionaries that were teachers. And that really influenced me greatly. Also kind of thinking about growing up, listening to hip hop music, or listening to rap music, or whichever we want to call it or term it, the sense of pride that I would take, because I didn't grow up in New York City, but I was born in New York City, born in the Bronx, but so I always kind of wanted to claim that and hold on to that. So when I would find out about a certain rapper that was from New York, there would be a sense of pride in that, because I would want to identify with them. But then as I became a teacher, I would think about, how there was always this emphasis on where this person was from. But so when the record label finds them and decides to market them and make them a political tool to promote and maintain the status quo of, neocolonialism, capitalism, Eurocentrism, anti-blackness, and all these other isms like hyper-consumerism, the drug trade, which just deals with chemical warfare, and especially the glorification of the drug trade, which on the one hand, it motivates young people to become drug dealers, but more so, I think, the more insidious part of the glorification of the drug trade in the music, what it does is it desensitizes the rest of us so that we don't have the same view of the drug dealer as we might have for the pedophile. Or the serial rapists, right? Because we've been desensitized because we dance to the music that talks about these stories. And, I have this saying that I put on social media from time to time is that, and I noticed this from working with students, is that if I can make you dance to it, I can make you believe it, right? So kind of considering all those things and then studying people historically and always, looking at a lot of biographical information and saying, okay, well, where was this brother from? Or where was this sister from? And then I kind of put two and two together, and I was thinking about geographic exemplar displacement, where I started to say to myself, I said, okay, well, I get it. I see why, a brother like Meek Mill has to be popular so that the young people will look at him and his example, and they will not look at a Mumia Abu-Jamal. They're both from Philadelphia, but Meek has to be the representative of young, the idea of young black manhood that has to be put forth. So Mumia Abu-Jamal will not be the idea of young black manhood that's put forth, or any of the other brothers that were involved with the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in the late 1960s, early 1970s, or a David P. Richardson won't be the example, you know, because of a rapper or an athlete, or it could be a bourgeois Negro politician. So, you know, and then, you know, we go through the whole country and you look at, you know, you might study Ida B. Wells and a lot of work that she put in Memphis, Tennessee, or later on in Chicago, Illinois. If you look, you know, look at all the rappers that are, you know, mainstream and popular, you know, in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, I always often think of Yo Gotti. Yo Gotti's a very popular mainstream rapper. But again, maintains the status quo, makes large sums of money, maintaining the status quo at the expense of our children and our children's minds and the colonization of our children's minds, and helps to maintain that. So you got to, he has to be the guy. So if you're from Memphis, you'll take pride in being from Memphis, and then he'll be the example. So you won't look to Ida B. Wells, or you'll be alienated from that example of Ida B. Wells. And we see these examples like all over the country, like, you know, Lil Wayne, great example from Louisiana. So you'll look at him, he becomes the symbol of black manhood if you're in Louisiana or from Louisiana, and not Imam Jamil Alami, formerly known as H. Rap Brown, who was also from Louisiana. So that was, I was looking at a geographic example of displacement. And then from there, I started thinking about, well, how can we correct that for our people and for our children and for our youth? And I started thinking about geographic exemplar replacement. So then it's like, okay, we identify. So really the methodology becomes, we just identify who's popular, who's been put out there by the mainstream. And then we say, okay, well, we go to that city that they're from, or that state that they're from, or that region or area that they claim. And then a lot of us have already done a lot of research, and we already know, and we can make the connections immediately. You know, like if we've done certain research and we've studied certain things and certain people, then when we hear of a city, we automatically are thinking like, oh, okay, such and such was from there, or okay, Columbus, Georgia, okay, John Henry Clark was born there, you know, or somebody talks about Puerto Rico. So if you've studied Arturo Schomburg, then you're thinking about Arturo Schomburg when you hear the name Puerto Rico. You hear Trump, you know, talking crazy about, you know, Puerto Rico and, you know, not wanting to give them financial support and whatnot. You know, when I'm hearing that in the media, I'm automatically thinking about Arturo Schomburg, or I'm thinking about Lolita LeBron, who was a political prisoner and who actually shot at the White House. You know, so those are some different examples. So, you know, but of course, like, you know, with Puerto Rico, you have a lot of, you know, there've been a lot of, you know, mainstream entertainers like Jennifer Lopez that were given, again, you know, that have made millions of dollars in terms of becoming an example or putting out an image to maintain status quo, or rappers like Fat Joe, you know, from the Bronx, New York, and a lot of these guys, you know. So that's why I come from with the kind of the idea of a geographic exemplar replacement, you know, and it kind of ties into the same reason that, you know, sports teams are popular. A lot of people like certain sports teams because it gives them an opportunity to represent the home team. But the question for us can be, well, okay, who, what does that home team really look like? So if you're from Philadelphia, is the representative, does the home team look like Richard Allen and what Richard Allen really did? Or does the home team look more like, I don't know, some other, like a bourgeois Negro local politician, you know? Or does the home team look like a Mumia Abu-Jamal? Or does the home team look like, you know, just some people that are more aligned with the black radical tradition, you know? But I think we can start with the geography and the physical space. And because that's something that everybody can agree on. You know, because somebody, if you're from Philly, you're from Philly. Or if you're from New York, you're from New York. From Atlanta, you're from Atlanta. From D.C., you're from D.C. But then the question becomes, okay, so who came before you? And it gets into genealogy and intellectual genealogy. And then you say, okay, well, who do I want to identify with that came before me that also walked these same streets and also was in this space? You know? And I think that's definitely a great way to engage the youth. Because really, because the youth need choices.
Okay.
Because I think a lot of times, you know, we know how the schools are functioning. The schools are not nourishing them intellectually at all. So they look to, a lot of times they'll look to the rappers as the only role models that they can really relate to because of what they're not being taught in the schools by design. So I think that, you know, we got to create spaces to be able to have these conversations with the youth. You know, if we're unable to infiltrate some of these school settings, these formal public charter, parochial or private school settings, then we can figure out how to create some of those spaces. And it don't even have to be like, you know, 50 youth or 30 youth for classroom size. It could be one or two, you know, in a library on a Saturday afternoon for an hour or something, or just a young brother you see on the corner and, you know, just pull up on him and just start having a conversation with him. If it seems appropriate and feasible, you know, but I guess that's just a little background on like my thinking and what kind of where I was, you know, kind of developed this, where why I started thinking about this geographic exemplar replacement.
So if I may, because I'm processing it and I'm saying, okay, Brother Kill. So we're talking about this methodology. So I want to make first, I want to be clear. It's the geography, it's the person, and the system of delivery. And you're saying replace the person, have the person identified with the area. And I apologize because I'm not rap literate, but say in the sense of Meek Mills, since kind of being in Philadelphia. So if you're looking for an exemplar image that young people would identify with, that we have to project, is there that say isn't Momia, but in that gerund of rappers, but that are pushing, because I'm kind of like, you know, say the Dead Prez or you know, Paris come to mind, you know, these are people I kind of listen to, but you're saying replacing them with somebody like that from their area.
Basically, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. And with a different political ideology. Mm. So we identify the needed. So we know what our goal is. And I guess we kind of got to look at it too in terms of like the work of Julius Nyerere. And when he talks about, even in terms of, because again, he was a teacher, you know, a person that influenced me, you know, when I'm thinking about what type of teacher do I want to be. So Nyerere becomes a leader of Tanzania, but Nyerere is originally a teacher. And Nyerere says, okay, if we're going to reform education, or not even reform, but revolutionize and change educational systems so we can decolonialize our people, we first, before we even start talking about teacher training or what type of curriculum we're going to use, we need to first look at, on a macro level, what type of society do we want? What type of country do we want? What type of nation do we want? So we're looking at things like that, like on a larger scale. And then from there, then we look at, okay, what political ideology do the examples that we want to promote, what does that political ideology look like? Because right now, in terms of May, if the powers that be currently, they want to maintain capitalism, want to maintain neocolonialism, not only maintain it, but empower it and strengthen it on a regular daily basis, they have to choose individuals that will be equipped to do that work through their art or through their propaganda. And a lot of, and these people, so you can have, you know, the popular rappers do this. This is meant to, just as an attack on the popular rappers, but let's be clear, let's be objective, let's be honest, like this is what they're doing. You know, Meek Mill makes millions of dollars from doing that. Yo Gotti mentioned makes millions of dollars from doing that. A lot of these guys, they're grown men and women. Cardi B makes millions of dollars from doing it. I mean, again, Cardi B is, I believe, of Puerto Rican descent. Or at least part Puerto Rican descent. So with her, geographic exemplar replacement. So if I'm Puerto Rican, I'm a young Puerto Rican girl, I might want to identify with her just because I'm Puerto Rican. Then you say, okay, sis, well, what about Lolita LeBron? I'm going to teach you about her. So now you can choose. Who do you really, it's like choose your hero. You can play a game called Choose Your Heroes. Who do you want to identify with? Well, I'm going to teach you about Arturo Schoenberg or, you know, Maria Bresetti. Somebody like some other people there, and then the list go on. But these are the people that are made obscure and that are hidden from the youth, And some of the people are hidden in plain view, because when I first started my teaching career, I taught at a school named after Mariana Bassetti. But I guarantee you that the vast majority of those students that were in that school, and that school is still open, still in existence today, have no idea of the work that Mariana Bassetti was doing. And probably, and students that go there now probably still don't. Probably the teachers in the building don't. Probably the administration in the building don't. The security guards. So, you know, and that's, you know, and that's across the board. I mean, there are people at Martin Luther King High School don't really know what King was really about. They might know about the I Have a Dream speech, but they've never read Why We Can't Wait. They've never read Strive Towards Freedom. They've never read Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community. Never really studied the War in Vietnam speech he delivered in 1967. Never really studied Dr. King, but have just been subjected to the sanitized historiographical versions of Dr. King that, you know, that we've all been given, you know, in order to maintain, you know, white supremacy theory and Eurocentrism, you know. So it's about giving the youth choices and then letting them know.
The question comes to mind, though, and I have that in the sense of, and I think this is important when we're talking about the methodology and the system, especially in our geography, because we have to look for those, in this case, artists, right, as replacement, right? That's one thing. So the question comes to mind.
It could be athletes, too. Athletes, or right. Just to listen to it real quick. Just it could be athletes or reality TV stars, because, you know, the youth are heavily invested in the athletes, the reality TV stars, some of these comedians, people that are famous through Instagram. There are people on Instagram that just do, you know, for lack of a better term, excuse my language, but do silly shit on Instagram all day long and get views and likes. And it's like, okay, well, you know, he might be funny, but in addition to him being funny, if he's from the city that I'm from, then okay, then that's my guy. I want to be like him. What were you saying before I cut you off?
No, because I'm looking at, like, where do we focus our gaze and identify where those people who are the exemplars are? Because we have to identify them, that's one, you know, so that we can be able to. And to me, and I think it's important for me to bring this up, Elliot, what you're raising, Akil, is that this has to go across generations, because all of us have to be able to speak to our next generation, or at least identify what they understand in order to communicate effectively with them. If we're talking about politically educating the next generation, right? We can't come with an identification that they don't deal with. If they're dealing with, and I apologize for using the same name, but if they're dealing with Meek Mills, but we don't have that other option, then we're not providing the solution that you're talking about. So my question is, do you see in our geographical areas, where are these people being cultivated? Is that an underground thing that we, because they're not being promoted by the mass media?
So you mean, I'm mainly talking about historical figures.
Okay.
In terms of contemporary figures, I don't know as many. I mean, there are contemporary figures, but the contemporary figures don't readily come to mind. You know, I'm more so the historical figures. Like I mentioned, Mumia.
Right.
And I think that, you know, the things that attract, a record label will look at the history of, yeah, and we keep talking about this brother, but, you know, the record label will identify a brother like Meek Mill and market him heavily because of his backstory and his history. And I would say there are people like Mumia that have similar backstories. Like, okay, right. You know, Mumia wasn't raised with a silver spoon in his mouth either. The question becomes, okay, like it's all about how do we solve the problem of poverty? How do we solve the problem of disenfranchisement? And some people say, okay, I just want to get rich. If I get rich, then I'll be fine. You know, some people say, and I think that's what a lot of the rappers, entertainers, athletes have done. That's what Meek Mill has done. That's what he raps about. That's what he talks about. That's what he propagandizes. And, you know, I mean, I would like to sit down with the brother and have a serious conversation with him about his political ideology, because I think he really truly believes that that's the way to go.
I heard him say that this was the first time he ever voted.
Without considering mathematically that the way capitalism is set up, everybody can't win like that. You know, everybody can't win. And like, it's not, But I think he really might believe that everybody can win if they just, you know, chase their dreams and, you know, get rich. But everybody won't get rich. But then some other people make the decision that, and they're able to do that, do a certain type of analysis where they do a systems analysis and they say, okay, I see that the ultimate goal should be we have to destroy this system and rebuild a better one and a more humane one. And while I'm doing that, the solution to that is not me getting rich and becoming well off within this system as an ultimate goal. You know, it's not to say that we might not, it's not to say, okay, you know, that we should just, I mean, some people might, I mean, we can have other, some people will have different arguments about, okay, in terms of acquiring resources while we are within the system, right? And how that's what that should look like. Because maybe you do need to acquire certain resources so that we can do certain things in the meantime. But some people are saying, some people will believe that the ultimate goal is just get rich and then live happily ever after and acquire, you know, $100 million, $200, $300 million. So, like, you know, you and your own personal biological lineage will be fine. But what about everybody else? What about the community? We know that the way the economic system is set up, that in order to accumulate that level, that type of wealth, there has to be, like Voltaire said this, you know, the comfort of the rich is dependent upon an abundance of the poor. So the richer you get, you know, that means it's going to be a whole lot of poor people out here. You know, it just has to be that way. So even if we temporarily are acquiring resources, we got to keep that in mind. And we got to be thinking about, okay, you know, at some point, you know, we're going to have to, because once you acquire a consolidated group of us, an amount of us acquire enough resources, then once we got the resources, we can institute any economic system we want. Just like those that had the resources 500 so years ago, they decided they wanted to institute capitalism or the type of capitalism we have now. And they were able to do that because they had the guns and they had the resources. So that's something else to think about. But what I'm saying is looking at the, and again, I'm still working through this whole methodology, looking at the current exemplars and who the youth are looking to for guidance, who the youth are looking to. Because, I mean, I've had young boys, you know, that were in my class, and when Meek went to jail, they said, man, I don't even go on Instagram no more because he's not posting anymore. So he's teaching. And your brother, and one of the things that I think is very key that we have to keep in mind is that Brother Shamari said this to me one day. He said from the Shamari Show, he said, the educators and the entertainers are the most important people in the society. The educators and the entertainers. And what's happened now, I can see from my own experience, is that the entertainers become the educators.
Right.
Well, they're
actually providing the training to the young people. Young people today, because they're sitting in my geometry class, and they don't want to learn. They don't want to hear me talk about triangle similarity theorems. They want to put their headphones in and sit in the back and listen to, you know, the Meek album, you know, because he's speaking to their experience based upon their socialization process and how they've been miseducated in the same schools that he went to. So they're relating to him. And I think that, but I think that also brings in.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Brother Parker.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is, so I think that if we can introduce the youth to some brothers and sisters that was saying, you know, let's change this society. Let's move differently. Instead of trying to fit into it and play the game, so to speak, so much, let's really think seriously about, you know, using our creativity to create a different system.
Yeah.
And there have been plenty of examples out there like that, but they're obscure. And they're purposefully hidden from the youth on purpose. So that they won't want to be like them.
Well, you know, what you're talking about is something that you're doing, and I'm glad that we're having this conversation, because when you're in a classroom, especially when you're at PASEP, and you're dealing with this, you're putting a clean glass before the dirty glass, so to speak.
Right. Right.
Speaking of,
if I could just jump in.
Go ahead.
Before I forget, my apologies, but before I forget, so PASEP, that's one of the, I guess my idea to come up with the Kwame Ture Speaks course ties directly into geographic exemplar replacement, because Trinidad has been such a pivotal and seminal island in the Caribbean in terms of the Black radical tradition, in terms of Pan-Africanism, and in terms of the work that has been done and the work that still will be done and is being done today. When you think about people like, that were born and raised in Trinidad, like Claudia Jones, that sister, or Tony Martin, who was the guy in terms of, the history and documentation of the UNIA, ACL, and the Garveyism, Kwame Ture himself. I mean, that's one of the exemplars that really helped to, help me develop myself politically and my own political ideology. It provided me a lot of political education through studying his work. Going further back, you got Henry Sylvester Williams, one of the architects of the first Pan-African conference, along with Du Bois and others, George Padmore, C.L.R. James. So all these people are coming out of Trinidad. And then again, but again, on the other side of that, you have probably one of the most famous, well-known entertainers in the world right now, and has been for several years, a woman by the name of Nicki Minaj, who is of Trinidadian descent. Born in New York, I believe. I believe she's born in Queens, but, Trinidadian descent. And then when I say that, so I can say, okay, now that I mentioned that, she's born in Queens. I believe she's born in Queens. I know she claims Queens, but who else is born in Queens? Asada Shakur, formerly known as Joanna Chesmard. So then for the sisters and the brothers, but this probably be even more instructive and more valuable to the sisters to say, okay, well, if Nicki is your hero and you follow her. And the thing is, it's like a lot of people will claim that, well, I just like the music. You might like the music and you like the beats, but you're being politically educated by the music. The music is providing a political education to you, like how you engage the society, how you deal with consumerism, how you deal with money, how you deal with male-female relationships, all these types of things.
Yeah, it's promoting.
If you're from Queens and you want to identify with a sister from Queens, that's cool. The mainstream and the white power structure gave you Nicki Minaj so that you would want to be like her and you want to live the lyrics that she speaks on, live the lyrics that she delivers. But I'm going to give you Asada Shakur. You want somebody from Queens? That's cool. I'm going to give you Asada Shakur. She's from Queens, too. So now you choose your hero. You know, so that's kind of like, and I guess this is, as I said earlier, this is an outgrowth of kind of like, actionable work that I have done in the classroom over the years. But this is my own thinking, because I'm, in terms of, trying to make connections with the youth and just a lot of the thousands of conversations that I've had with different students at different times and, during the school day, after school, in between classes, in the hallway, wherever, whenever. So I'm kind of just trying to document it and trying to formalize it and figure out a way that it can be duplicated and replicated, in more and more spaces throughout.
What you're talking about kind of ties into what the caller was talking about just before you came on, about our people adopting a code of ethics. See, when you mentioned about these images being propagated in our community and massively spread by media, you got an unseen hand that's doing this. The Meek Millses, the Nicki Minajs, they're all over the community. But the images that they're promoting is not all over the community. It is spreading in the community. It's these other folks that develop these people, that put money behind them, that's not of our community, and a lot of them are of Jewish descent, that are promoting these negative images in our communities. It's necessary for us, just like you're saying, to show them people that have our people's culture in mind, that had a cultural ethic behind them, that had principles behind them, that we have to show these images to our youth. We can't show, and it's, a lot of it is not these young people's fault. And when I say young people, I'm talking about the entertainers. They don't realize that they're being guided by somebody else necessarily. Some of them might. Some of them do. But when they, all this type of lewd behavior and doing it just for the sake of money, everything is not about money. I think it's a battle that we have to face, because these images that are going all over media, whether it's social media or visual or even print, These images are powerful, but we have to come up with ways to counteract these images.
And what you're saying is, and what you're saying, Brother Akil, is that we have to be knowledgeable of what those alternatives are,
right,
in order to be able to present to put them, and they be maybe equal mm-hmm. relationship, primarily because of their geography, that whether they're historical figures or figures within the art or sports arena, that they come from the same place that the young person we're speaking to comes from as a starting point. You know, it's interesting, Elliot and then Brother Akil, that what you're saying about the replacement seemed to have came up in the discussion. I think it was Brother Michael Chance on BF Nkrumah who raised that, you know, he said the same thing in the sense of you have to provide an option.
Yeah, an alternative.
Alternative when we're talking to young people. And this young people dialogue is really important, because if we don't figure out how to combat the commercial media, because that's what we're doing, right? We're actually in combat with commercial media, whether that be the sports entertainers or whatever, and providing these options in a direct communication form. That's the other challenge I see in what you're raised, because as you say, Elliot, the communication form, they penetrate every area of our relationship,
right?
Like, you know, I see young people, they're carrying the music in their ear, they're even now watching replays of the game, or they're playing a game, a sports game that is not necessarily real. So we have to be able to have something really to be able, when they speak, when we speak of that historical person that shows that code of conduct or the, I'm wondering, how do we become aware of those examples? I mean, you gave example of Trinidad and gave right. a history of individuals, but that means we have to be educated to that too, right?
I mean, I think we can. I mean, we could do some very direct things in terms of in our community. There are a lot of people that have done scholarship and have produced scholarship and have done a lot of research and may not even really understand the value of the research that they've done. I mean, people that have went to graduate school or went to undergrad, or people that are teaching on a college level, or people that have just studied on their own, just in isolated study groups. And they may know about people that are from, you know, these different cities and different places, either within the United States or on a global scale, and not understand that, okay, well, this record label just put out an artist that has captured the attention and the imagination of the youth. So it's like, okay, now we need somebody to counter him. You know, we need somebody to, because what they've done is, because it's really, what they're doing by putting out that artist is counter-revolutionary, because there have been revolutionary people that are already from that space. So what they're trying to do, and my theory is that they're trying to put this person out there to counter any type of revolutionary, potential revolutionary fervor by people identifying with people that were from that space that were of a revolutionary nature or mm-hmm. revolutionary perspective or positioning. So then we have to counter it back, you know, but we can look, we can reach out to people and say, okay, well, who can you give me that was from, I don't know, Kansas City? Who can you give me that was from Chicago? I mean, it was literally hundreds of people from Chicago that would come to mind, but, you know, but just as an idea, who from Seattle, you know, who from Dallas, Texas, or Houston, Texas, you know, so we can compare, so we can get a youth of choice. And another thing I think we have to think about too, in terms of marketing and the propaganda, is that they have to constantly bombard the youth with it, because it's actually weak and it's of low quality, because it's falsehood, because it's a lie. It's a false reality that the youth, that in order for this whole system to operate and function, the youth have to buy into it. So you have to constantly tell them that it makes sense. So you have to constantly give them these artists that are telling them the same propaganda over and over again. You can't just give it to them once and then it's like, okay, it sinks in, because it's counter to reality. It's counter to humanity. It's counter to human nature. So you got to constantly give it to them in the form of songs, in the form of billboards, in the form of social media, in the form of television, in the form of other types of entertainment. You got to constantly give it to them. So the thing is like when we come with truth, when we come with those that were offering ideologies that were more in tune with humanity and the promotion of humanity and human ideals, you don't even need to constantly bombard people with that, because it has much more strength within it. Now, I mean, you do want to expose it a lot because of what we're up against, but just keeping in mind that what the mainstream is giving us in terms of the neocolonialism, in and of itself, it's weak. That's why I think they have to constantly bombard us with it. That's another point. But another point I want to make in terms of, again, with the rappers and the youth, even myself, when I was young, growing up, listening to rappers, the things that attracted me to the rappers and a lot of my friends to the rappers was that we thought they were gangsters. They talked about guns and they talked about shooting people and they talked about, you know, being macho, and they provided this image of black manhood. But then as you get older, you start studying revolutionary movements, independence movements. I mean, Africa is a great place for that, because then you start to look at brothers like Thomas Sankara. You start to look at brothers like Amilcar Cabral. You start to look at brothers like Samora Michelle. And those are just a few, but you start to look at them and then you sit back and you say, wait, what's more? These guys are talking about shooting other black men around the corner from them over drug dealing. That's what these rappers are talking about. We're looking at them like they are the symbol of black manhood. But then you step back and you think more critically and you say, what's more gangster than going up against the whole imperialist nation? And and they got guns too, like Amilcar Cabral. I got a poster in my living room. And I used to have another poster in my classroom with Amilcar Cabral kind of chilling, you know, with brothers on flanking him on left and right, holding AK-47s, you know. And a lot of rap albums have had people posing with guns, you know. And you know, so it's that same energy. But the question is, okay, who are the rappers talking about shooting at? Another black man around the corner, you know. And who was Amilcar Cabral talking about shooting at? He's talking about shooting at the Portuguese that have been oppressing them for years in a revolutionary struggle. Who was Thomas Sankara, you know, walking around with a .45 caliber pistol on his hip? And he's like, okay, no, we're going to war with the French because we want our land. We want our independence. We want Pan-Africanism. So in Samora Michelle, also going to war with the Portuguese. So a lot of the same things that attracted me and my friends when I was younger, and attract the youth today, 20 years later, 30 years later, to the same type of, I guess, gangster rap or violent music. They can be appealed to. That's why I know that's why I'm very confident that this can work if it's implemented properly, because a lot of the same elements are present. You know, it's a lot of the same elements.
Well, you know, doesn't require. Richard, hold on a second. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to continue the conversation with Professor Akil Parker, and you can get involved too by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We got a couple calls on hold, and we'll get to
them
right after the break. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215 215-
215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
You know how we think. Organize the hood under our chain banners. Red, black, and green instead of gang bandanas. FBI spying on us through the radio antennas. And I'm hitting cameras in the street like watching society. With no respect for the people's right to privacy. I take a slug for the cause like Huey P. While all you fake niggas try to copy Master P. I wanna be free to live, able to have what I need to live. Bring the power back to the street where the people live. I'm sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons. Dying over money and relying on religion for help. We do for self like ants in a colony. Organize the wealth into a socialist economy. A way of life based off the common needs. And all my comrades is ready, we just spreading the seed.
Black man, live a third of his life in a jail cell. Cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice. And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough. So the rent always be late. Can you relate?
No more bondage, no more political monsters, no more secret space launches. Government departments started it in the projects, material objects, thousands up in the closets. Could have been invested in the future for my comrades. Battle contacts, primitive weapons out in combat. Many never come back, pretty niggas be running with gas. Rather get shot in they back than fire back. We tired of that. Corporations hiring blacks, denying the facts, exploiting us all over the map. That's why I write the shit I write in my rap. It's documented, I meant it. Every day of the week, I live in it, breathing it. It's more than just fucking believing it. I'm holding in ones, rolling up my sleeves and shit. It's Z-Lo for push-ups now. Many headed for one conclusion. Niggas ain't ready for revolution.
Your average black male, live a third of his life in a jail cell. Cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice.
And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough. So the rent always be late. Can you relate? We living in a police state.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And we're in conversation with Professor Akil Parker. And we're going to go right back to our guests and to the phones. So that brother Professor Parker, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I just want to say one thing real quick. It's just, I'm still getting used to, it's kind of funny to me, I'm still getting used to the title, Professor. so used to, you know, being, I guess, what some would say, a lowly high school teacher, you know? Well, it's just funny, man. I just want to throw that out there.
You're doing,
well, I appreciate it.
You're doing the work, so, you know, a servant is worthy of his hire.
Yeah, just playing my part. That's what I always say. I'm just playing my part.
Let's go to 404. 404?
Hey, peace and blessings, Brother Elliot, Richard, and our professor. Hey, professor, man, I like your energy, what you're trying to do, man. It just don't happen. But Elliot was trying to explain you behind the hidden hand that's running all this, that's making this these youths do what they do against each
right.
other. See, I'm 61, man, and I grew up with the music. We had love music, and I don't never recall Aretha Franklin arguing with Diana Ross, because what I saw with that Cardi B and that what's that Nicki Minaj fight, man,
right.
that
right.
stuff, this beefing stuff, gotta stop, bro. Okay, all right. So if you look up, go to a website called A Secret Meeting to Change Hip Hop to Rap, and how they did it was so smooth. When they changed, they started with that damn battle rap shit. Remember that battle stuff? Sucker MC this, sucker MC that. Remember that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's how they flipping the script on us to have these fighting each other. So if you can get to the youth and tell them to cut this beefing out, man. Okay, because we are at war. Okay, simple right. as that. We can't. We got to stop taking these. Our soldiers out, man. Okay? This still got to stop, man. So I studied conflict resolution. I talked to Richard about that, where no matter what, okay, you tell the new, no matter what, if they get in a debate with somebody, they got disagreement, and you got to shut it down after 3 minutes, man. Okay? Because you know in 3 minutes, that's a boxing match, right? They don't even let no boxing match go past 3 minutes round. Because after 3 minutes, all bets are off, man. Okay,
right.
And see, they flipped the tone of the music, man. I studied music from in 1979, from positive music to low frequency music, got them fighting. That's why Jay-Z come out with that 440 Hertz. Okay, it's deeper than what it is. But I like what you're doing, man. But you gotta tell them, man, they gotta cut this beefing out, man. Okay, that's the main thing they gotta quit doing, man. Okay, even me, I have to check myself when I'm talking to my brothers and sisters. Okay, because we got to cut this out, man. That's the only way we gonna flip the script, bro. I'm 61 years old, man, and this, we got to cut this out, man. This because we taking each other out, bro, and that's the main thing to get to the youth about, man. It's positive stuff, man. Positive music out, man, but. This here beefing and stuff, man. What y'all think about that, Elliot and Richard?
No, I agree with you. And listen, a lot of this stuff is promoted by the same folks that we're talking about. You know, these other folks have different grievances and things like that, but you don't see it being made public and promoted.
Right.
They're promoting these things. When you see 50 Cent going at it with another guy, that done made social media rounds and this fight with like you said, Cardi B and this other Nicki Minaj, all this stuff is promoted. It's promoted. It's similar to this crap that some of the youth watch with the young ladies and all fighting all on TV, or the housewives and basketball wives and whoever's wives. This stuff is promoted.
True.
These negative.
Can I add on to what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
I think in keeping with the concept that the again, Brother Shamari saying that the educators and entertainers, and I agree with him wholeheartedly. Educators and entertainers being the most important in the society and within the community, the entertainers have become the educators. So a lot of the activity that the entertainers involve themselves in become the standard, mm-hmm. and they actually offer a blueprint for existence, for behavior, and it socializes the young people. So the young girls will see that, okay, this is normalized, and these women have large sums of money.
Exactly.
In this society, you're seen as successful, you're seen as the person that should be listened to if you have large sums of money, or at least if we think you have large sums of money, because we don't know exactly how much they have. The amounts that somebody can Google in terms of net worth may not be true, and then we got to talk about liquidity, but that's another conversation. But what I'm saying is that what it does is there's an economic value to that can be assigned to their beef, because then you have, black women, not only black women, but black people, black men, just again being further reinforced with this idea that we cannot unite. We can't even have operational unity. We don't gotta always agree. We definitely don't have to be uniform, but we have to agree on some, be able to put our differences aside to achieve some things politically and achieve some things economically. And as long as we're not doing that, those that are promoting, as you say, promoting these rat beefs, they continue to win,
mm-hmm.
because it leads to dysfunction in the community. And the more dysfunction there is in our community, because Amos Wilson talks about this all the time, this is kind of zero-sum game of white supremacy and or Eurocentrism, this zero-sum game, whereas, if we're down, then they're up. We can't all be up together within this yes, system, sir. And the way this is set up.
If you get in contact with Professor Grip, okay, I think you join forces with him, because he's easy to talk to, Lance, okay?
Uh-huh.
And he know about how they flip the music, because he's trying to do something too, man. But if you get in contact with Professor Grip, I think y'all would be good allies, man.
I think that also, Brother Akilah, what you're raising, and I think, it's important for us to realize that, correct me if I'm wrong, that we have to be able to identify those options within our geography. And
right.
I think that the issue that we have, and it also shows our isolation, regardless of our age, because we know the music we grew up with. We know the entertainers that we grew up with. The point of being able to communicate with the generations before is to be able to know the people in their space that you can use as the option. And I don't think that isn't promoted by the mass media, because in order to be able to do that change, that's a learning curve we have to go through, because if we don't, then it only maintains that isolation between generations.
But let me add something on, because I want to respectfully push back on the elder's comment a little bit, with all due respect, in terms of rap beef. I think that rap beef in and of itself is not the problem. I think because beef can be kept brotherly, and it can be kept sisterly. But when it gets but we definitely can tell when it's not just about, not just about healthy competition. And it's not, it's really about, okay, I really don't like her, or I really don't like him, when it's really just it becomes very petty and very, very, very pernicious. When it becomes pernicious, then that's something different. But again, and when I think about rap beef, and I think Jared Ball down in Morgan State, he talks about this too. Like, he would like to see more kind of this type of rap beef type of phenomenon among intellectuals. He would like to see more of it. And I think about, and I agree with him in terms of that. I think that, it makes me think of Jacob Carruthers' work in Intellectual Warfare. In Jacob Carruthers' work, he has a section, either a chapter or a section called The Intellectual Civil War. And because there's some things that, us as a community, we're gonna have to iron out, because and within the black community, some of us are advocates of a revolutionary black nationalism, but then there are others of us that are heavy, strong advocates of Negro assimilationism. So in order for us to advance, because, those that want to advocate Negro assimilationism are putting out a lot of propaganda and
You're
control of certain institutions, and they're influencing young people to want to also pursue Negro assimilationism. So at some point, we're going to have, I mean, we've been, on some levels, we've been beefing with them already. We're going to have to continue to beef with them. And I mean, and if you think about it historically, like one situation comes to mind, I think about Walter Rodney in Guyana and Forbes Burnham, who I believe had him murdered, right? So that was beef between those different camps, right. And it ended in the death of Walter Rodney. But I think that beef was necessary because, you know, Walter Rodney could have just bowed down, and then, you know, maybe the progress that we have yet to make, we would be even further away from the progress that we've yet to make. You know,
well, my brother,
so I think we should be strategically.
Where I sit, and when me and Elliot and a lot of other people, young people and old people, that Negro inflationism and integration stuff ain't working, man. So there, we might well throw that out, man. Because I'm going to give you a perfect example. It's a sister, her name's Zoe something. She was at that little Trump rally. She a model. And she was at the little Trump rally at the White House when they paid all them young people to come there. George, Koch brothers paid for them young folks to sit up there in Trump White House a couple of weeks ago. Young sister, she a pretty thing, a model, okay? She took a picture with that red maggot hat on and her and Trump's son. Do you know the modeling agency fired her and got on and that's trying to fit in crap, okay? Now she's figuring out the hard way that she got to take that doggone wig off her head, and she's black. They showed her that, okay? Uh-huh. That's what that trying to fit in ism, and ain't working, man. It's separation time, man.
And the thing about it,
thank you for your call, man.
From my study, I've come to appreciate the pursuit of integrationism and Negro assimilationism only for the, like, looking at it scientifically. It's like, listen, like, brothers and sisters, like, we tried this and it didn't work. Yeah. So now it's like there's plenty of documented evidence. But again, that's why the study becomes important, because a lot of people haven't done that research and that reading to know that it hasn't worked. Because you got people really walking around here thinking that it can work and still, when there's so much documented evidence that has been made obscure, is not being offered in the schools by design. So I'm not going to complain about that. But there's plenty of information available, just like in terms of science. It's like, okay, if a scientist is trying to find a cure for something, and he goes through certain trials, and he's running tests on laboratory mice, and he's testing, you know, going through, you know, using this chemical and then using that chemical. And okay, well, these 20 chemicals did not work. It didn't cure the disease. So now we know that these 20 chemicals don't work. So now we got going to something else. So that's how integrationism is. It only might benefit certain individuals at certain times.
It benefits the white folks, man. Because I'm not to touch y'all, but I just want to cut into what me and Elliot were talking about earlier about the voting thing, about how the white women didn't vote with the sister and brother. Because, see, you look at the number one group that's always calling the police on black people is who? White women, right, Elliot? All the whole year, every time you look around, some fat white devil calling the police on a brother or sister, okay? And so that right there showed me, and I knew that they wasn't going to vote for no black candidate. It was only one exception to the rule that they voted for was Miss Lucy McBath up here in Georgia. Okay? That's the woman that her son got killed, Jordan Davis, got killed for playing music loud in the car. Okay?
Right.
And
I remember that.
She ran against a white woman in Georgia, racist Karen Hamlin Jew lady. I was shocked. That I don't know if they manipulated the vote for her to win, but that's the district where old Red and they had gerrymandering for Newt Gingrich. And so I was shocked that black lady Lucy McBath won against that Karen Handel. That right there amazes me how that happened. But I don't want to talk too much, Elliot, but I appreciate this. I got my point across, man. I won't say yo to my brother Tim that called in Newt, but It's like y'all say, that integration stuff ain't happening, man. I wish Jesse and them would have had us have our own cow and cook our own hamburger instead of going to their restaurant trying to eat their hamburger.
Thanks for your call, Brother West.
Oh, one more thing, Elliot, about the governor thing, man, about y'all governor, right? the governor got the power to pardon folks, right? The governor, right?
Yes.
Is that right? So I think it might be a time, since that governor said what he said, everybody in Philly and Pennsylvania and the world, to get him to pardon Mamil, okay? Since he want to say that, I think everybody should go and get Mamil pardoned, man. Get that governor, let that brother go.
Yeah, well, that wasn't part of an agenda, Wes, but listen, thank you for your call, man.
And see, one more, hey, let me put one more point in the pot, man. You see that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The agenda, I had an agenda for Stacey Abrams, okay? And my agenda was for her to, with this criminal justice thing, after 7 years, to get people record sealed. Okay, that's what I was getting ready to come to her with that. And one more thing, for the senior citizens, anybody that's been in their house over 25 years and paid their property taxes, they should be exempt from paying property taxes, all the senior citizens, man. So that's just my agenda. See, I got some stuff to throw at these folks, man.
Thanks,
got to.
Thanks for your call, Wes.
Appreciate it, man. Peace and blessings.
Peace.
Nice talking to you.
Let's go to 404 again. 404? 404? Let's put them back on hold. Let's go to 443. 443? 443, are you there? Let's put them back on hold. Maybe they stepped away. Let's go. I know this brother ain't stepped away. Let's go to 646. 646.
Brother Elliot, Brother Richard, how are you?
With
your guest this evening.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing excellent, sir. Listen, rap music back in the day was a beautiful thing. Today, it's of no value. Or very few value. How do you, being an advanced society and be in the position to move yourself forward as a people, excuse me, with individuals like Nicki Minaj and Cardi B? They're what you really call culture bandits, because they're not even authentic, as one would say, Americans. They come from people who come from someplace else to be a component of something that is destructive to one's civilization and culture. Think about it. One could not say that they are authentic African Americans, Trinidadians, Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, and even, you know, as one would say, American blacks. And in the process, what they've done to the mindset of African women is a damn shame. But we follow this nonsense. We look up to individuals like that. And in the process, what do they do but cause damage?
Well, listen, and I'm going to let the Brother Keel weigh in on this, but Jay, see, I'm not putting, sure, they bear some responsibility, but these are the two that you talk about are young women, and they see dollar signs. They might not know the full implications of what they're being used for or what they're doing. So I'm not really going to put the full weight on them. Like, this is their whole idea. They did this. They're originators of this. No, they're being used.
They're being used.
Yeah.
No. Don't. I'm not saying they're not being used. They definitely being used. But the thing is, a lot of us don't understand who's using them, and they know more than one would assume that they know. You're not dealing with individuals who are oblivious or stupid to how they're being used. I believe they know enough not to be used in the manner in which they are being used. You know what I mean? Because it's funny, I've listened to interviews by, you know, Cardi B, and she always talks about how she understands civics and how she went to college and how she's in the history and this and that. And I've heard interviews by Nicki Minaj. But, you know, it's not only them. It's all of them in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
So one would have to ask ourselves, even though I know, as one would say, the man is putting them up to it and dictating the terms and the way that it's moved forward, one would have to ask yourself, in a sense, listening to, like the brother said, of a Meek Mill. Now, I always ask myself this one fundamental question whenever I listen to them over an extended period of time. What have they read and what have they been taught by those who supposedly their supporters? Give you a classic example. Meek Mills is supposed to be good friends with Lamont Hill. Now, Mark Lamont Hill is supposed to be super Negro. Am I right or wrong? He's supposed to be somewhat conscious and all this and that. So I ask myself, what type of politicization is he getting from Lamont Hill? But then again, who is he talking about as one of his best friends? The owner of the Philadelphia 76ers. So, I mean, you know, that's what I'm saying. You're getting information, but the question is, how are you processing information?
So I would say that, well, a couple of things. I appreciate you calling in, brother. But a couple of things I would say is, I do think that those relationships that Meek Mill supposedly has with Mark Lamont Hill and also the owner of the 76ers, I think a lot of that is media hype. I don't think he's as close with, not to excuse the behavior, but I don't think he's as close as they might have us to want us to believe. That's one thing. But another thing is that I think the value in the rap music, if we look at things from a less reactionary position, and if we take a more proactive and a more revolutionary approach to to attacking neocolonialism, and we look at this in the context of anti-colonial struggle, then really a lot of the mainstream rap music, what it does is it lets us know. It's like Sun Tzu, Art of War. We study our enemies like by utilizing them. But we have to, and that kind of ties us to. So it was four key points that I wanted to discuss tonight. I don't know if we have time tonight, but that gets us into one of the other key points, which is checking the lyrics and looking at rap lyrics as looking at the political gravity of the rap lyrics and kind of just stripping down the beat, removing the beat, and just looking at the lyrics as, okay, like what is the historical significance of this? What is the political significance of this? What is the economic significance of this, line for line and word for word? And using that as a tool to develop to provide political education to the children. So it's not just a song, because the rappers, and here's another problem. This is something I had to recognize in myself and my own growth. Growing up, I thought that, and I kind of bought into the record label marketing of, okay, KRS-One is seen as a political rapper. He's a conscious rapper. He's a political rapper. Who are like Nas, to an extent, was seen as a conscious rapper, and by default, a political rapper. But even the mainstream rapper that talks, you know, everybody can, you know, 9 out of 10 people in a room can agree that this music is nonsense. They might love the beat, they might bob their head to it, but they'll still agree this music is nonsense. Even that rapper is very political, like the Migos, for example, very political. Anytime you're talking about, you know, telling young people to use drugs recreationally, and that's not to say that, you know, even, you know, singers in the 70s and the 60s didn't talk about using drugs, but to the level that is discussed now is very different, I think, than, you know, in those eras, and especially when you look at the sum total, right? So all that is very political. The participation in the drug trade is very political. Hyper-consumerism is very political. And of course, that's going to lead to economic outcomes for certain groups that are positioned to make income and to be able to acquire more and more resources to maintain their power and control and their hegemony globally. You know what I'm saying? So I think the value in it, even the music that we agree, we kind of talk about as trash. Like my father growing up would always talk about, you know, certain music I would listen to, is he would always call it trash. but it has a value because it's that trash is very political, and it almost lets you know, okay, this is what these people are about to do to us. They're telling us this message. So this kind of tells us, okay, this is what they want us to think. This is what they want the young people to think. So this is what the young people are about to start doing unless we intervene and give them a different blueprint, a different soundtrack.
Wow.
Because they're gonna do, like I said earlier, if I can make you dance to it, I can make you believe it. So if they're dancing to the song talking about popping Perk 30s, smoking weed all day, drinking liquor, and that's all they want to do, and there's no balance between that and reading or doing anything of any intellectual value or anything to enhance humanity, there's no balance at all, right? You know, they're just kind of existing just as parasites and just like hedonists that are just trying to feel good constantly and like practice escapism, then we know what we need to do. And, you know, to Elliot's point, Kwame Ture in a lecture, you know, was very clear about the fact that the rappers are just the straw men. They are straw men. They are the tools of, I want to be careful with the words I use, because they are the tools of a white controlled mainstream media. But at the same time, they are grown men and women, and they are making decisions. You know, and I think some of them do have more of an awareness than others. Some of them do know, okay, well, politically, I know what the outcome is going to be of this music that I'm putting out. Economically, I know what the outcome is going to be. But I'm trying to make $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll sacrifice. It's an act of utilitarianism on their part. They're saying, you know, they want to make $10 million. So I don't care about these children that are going to listen to this. And then they'll play the whole, you know, hot potato game with, in terms of responsibility. They say, well, you know, their parents shouldn't let them listen to it. And that's convenient to say, but what if the parents aren't available? Parents aren't around. What if the parents are working three jobs, you know, and don't have the time or the ability or the wherewithal to really monitor, even if they should? The fact of the matter is not ideally what should happen, but ideally what is happening. So I agree with your point that a lot of the rappers do know better and do know what they're doing, and they've chose to make money to be able to provide for themselves and their own families. Which is just an extension of rugged individualism, because we can call, like, I think Amos Wilson talked about that. He called it familyism, you know, rugged familyism. You know, it's just like, okay, instead of me just looking out for me, I'm looking out for me, and my son, my daughter, my niece, my nephew, and my mom, you know, and that's it. And yeah, it's like, the rest of y'all, hell with the community.
Yeah, but the question always boils down to, is that behavior sustainable? Do they have one would call careers? Will they be able to stay into the spotlight and influence people? It's like, if you take someone like Carly B, I would assume, from the way I vision her, I honestly think that her career would be better much served in television. You know what I mean? I believe she could, in all truthfulness, be one of the best comedian actresses of this gender. She has the ability to be like that woman from Modern Family. I've even seen in the newspaper where Fran Drescher is talking about creating a television show with her. Now, will her rap career or supposed rap career be something that is sustainable? I don't know. But the point is, like you said, the damage that she's doing at this present time to the culture is really serious, man, because her influence, along with her husband and the others within that genre and that circle, is extremely damaging when you talk about how are we going to progress, or how are young people going to progress into, you know, becoming warriors? Because, like, you know, like you said, think about our generation coming up. I'm probably, like, maybe 15, 20 years older than you, brother. And so whereas, you know, the generation of Elliot, as far as music go, and Richard, and now coming up to the music that is being presented to these young people today, along with their lack of interpersonal skills, the ability to have conversations and do some of the things that is this music influential in regards to their development, we had a real dangerous point in time, bro. Because anytime you have kids who would rather be on the computer than outside playing, you know what I mean? You got some deep, deep problems ahead of you. Because, you know, most kids can't even have a conversation with one another without maybe texting or something else. So I don't know.
Yeah. Can I respond to that? So, I mean, just overall, I think that we are not going to be able to change what we can influence it, but overall, at least immediately, we won't be able to change what the mainstream media is gonna produce and gonna put out there. And I think a lot of times, a lot of us, I just look at this within myself. I mean, a lot of us get upset at what the rappers are doing sometimes, at least myself in the past, because we look at them as if we don't look at this kind of with a military perspective. We look at this with sentiment instead of just cold, calculated objectivity. And I think we need to look at this with some more cold and calculated objectivity and look at this as, okay, this is what they're doing. Okay, cool. A lot of us get upset, I think, because we look at like the rappers or the entertainers or whoever as part of us, like they're part of our family. And to an extent, maybe they are. But once they make that decision and cross that line and bow down and pledge allegiance to neocolonialism and the promotion of it and decide they're going to put out propaganda that is really going to promote the menticide that Dr. Bobby Wright talked about and basically, murder our children psychologically and psychically, then we just have to say, okay, you're not with us. So it is what it is. They made their choice. They wanted to get the money. So that's one thing. But again, with methodology of, to go back to that geographic exemplar replacement, we could just give them I think Brother Elliot I'm not sure it was you or Richard referred to earlier, Elijah Muhammad with the clean glass, dirty glass. They're giving us the dirty glass constantly. Mm-hmm. And so with this, my intent is to give them the clean glass. So give the youth the clean glass and let them make the choice. But with the caveat, though, because we have to be clear, we don't want to create other problems. We have to dodge the hagiography. The hagiography or the too much of the, I mean, cult of personality is not as bad as a lot of people make it out to be. It can be beneficial, but with the hagiography and kind of putting out individuals and exemplars, we do have to let people know that these individuals were not superhuman, immortal, Marvel comic book characters. They definitely weren't. They were part of movements. They were part of the Black radical tradition. They were part of organizations. Another thing Kwame Ture talked about constantly, organize, organize, organize. We must all be part of organizations. As a way to motivate youth to become part of organizations or to start organizations. And that gets them away from the rugged individualism because they're looking at, okay, I'm part of a group. And these people that are exemplars were parts of groups. So because sometimes we can, you drop a name and you say, okay, well, that person was great and they were this and that. But then a lot of people internally are looking at that person like, wow, they were great. They were superhuman. I could never, in their mind, they're saying to themselves, I could never do what they did. So I'm going to just stay in my lane and not even try to become involved without understanding that, no, Malcolm X was great because he was a part of an organization. He was always part of an organization. King was great in part because, I think there were some extraordinary characteristics and qualities about these men and a lot of the women, like Assata Shakur and Ida B. Wells and other people. But they were part of groups, and they were part not only part of groups, but part of an intellectual genealogy and a lineage. And they were carrying on tradition. That's another thing too. So I think that we can accept the fact that the mainstream media is going to keep giving us what they're giving us because they have a goal, and the people that they give us maintain and help them to achieve their goal. And we just have to give the youth something different, and we can meet the youth where they are. And we can look at the reason, and again, it goes to we can analyze the current entertainment that the youth are consuming and say, okay, well, what is it that makes you want that? What is it that makes you like that? What is it that makes you connect to that? And then we can say, okay, well, who are these historical figures that were about anti-colonial struggle, that were about the uplift of African people globally and locally, that were about revolutionary black nationalism, that also embodied many of those same things? Then we can say, okay, you know, because I look at, for example, I look at Kwame Ture when he was still Stokely Carmichael. I look at Jamil Alameen when he was still H. Rap Brown. Look at them, listening to them speak in the late 60s and in the 70s. They have the same energy as the most popular rappers of the last 20 years. They have the same energy. The difference is the content. That's the only difference. They have the same swag, the same appeal. Like, you look at them in pictures, you know what I'm saying? Oh, these brothers were cool. You know, so and kind of like with, I'm sure I've heard this conversation a lot. A lot of people became, you know, attracted to the Black Panther Party because they said, these brothers are cool. They got black leather jackets and berets. They look cool. I want to be down with that. But once you get down with that, then it's like, oh, okay, then they have a political orientation that is one that will help us to advance as a people instead of us just, you know, cooning and shucking and jiving so we can become millionaires and get these checks from these record labels or these, you know, major conglomerates or these, you know, athletic organizations or these sports teams or whoever. You know, or these television channels or whoever. So I think, yeah, we have to figure out ways to impart some options to
Well, brother, good luck with what you're doing, man. Keep up the fight. It sounds good, and you know, the one thing is that you're doing is you're asking us to hold them accountable for their actions in regards to the community, and you know, in all honesty, what more could we ask for? You know what I mean? From people like yourself, but to do the good work which you are doing. So the best of luck to you, and you know, we gonna be all right. You know, we've always been in a situation where we've had to move forward as a people, and you know, do what we gotta do. But hey, Richard and Elliot, man, y'all have a good week, and listen, the Sickle fans, by the time you come back on Friday, they may be up in the uproar over your girl Michelle Obama new book, man. Because, hey, listen, Target feels so good about it, they got it going for $15.99, I heard.
Well, you better, know what I mean? So you better get it.
Your brothers and sisters may be able to pick that up, you know what I mean, to give her a bestseller, because I'll leave you with this right quick. I was listening to the Wilbur Leon show yesterday, man, and Wilbur Leon called her the Taz because she got upset because of, you know, what Trump did, and as she said, he placed her children in danger. So Wilma said, well, hey, did she ever speak about the children that her husband killed over in Iran and, you know, Iran and Iraq and Libya? And, you know, man, when he said that, her Sickle friends, they called up and gave that poor man absolutely hell. He had to really, really check him. You know, it was basically like you couldn't question nothing about her or her husband, because I've never heard her chastise her husband for what he did, for killing all of the innocent babies that he's killed, you know, as the head of the so-called free world. Now, if she feels so bad about 45 talking and placing her children in jeopardy, shouldn't she be morally responsible to say something about all of the deaths of innocent children?
Jay.
Have a good one,
as
brother.
Always, okay. Thank you. Thank you for your call, man.
You, brother.
Brother Kiel, I have to ask you. I mean, as you lay this out, and I've seen you develop this, you know, in raising the questions over Facebook, particularly, and I think that's what you've been doing, and bringing it, you know, full flesh here. The question again comes to my mind: do you think with amongst teachers who are dealing with more directly with the students and age group that you're, you're looking at and speaking to, that they have an understanding of how to utilize this. I like what you said about breaking the rap lyrics down, the politicalization information within them to do that. Or do they sound, and I'm thinking to myself and others who may sound, that that's for y'all to do, or that generation to do, because I come from another generation where we did something different, or we didn't have the same circumstance, which I don't agree with. But, you know, do you see the teachers or people who directly service young people have that understanding, or a cadre that has that understanding?
Yeah, there definitely are some, you know, definitely are some. I mean, shout out to the Philadelphia Black History Collaborative. And when we linked up at the conference last year, I believe.
Right.
You know, shout out to them. And you know, there are a lot of teachers out here doing that work, and kind of looking at things through that lens already. So, and you know, again, you know, rest in peace to Lerone Bennett Jr. His famous quote, you know, a teacher is either going to be a tyrant or a liberator. So, you know, I think those teachers that are conscientious enough and aware enough to understand that distinction, that, you know, oftentimes, even if you're well-meaning, if you're promoting the status quo of the current society, then you are operating as a tyrant, and you're not serving to liberate our youth. But those that are doing that work, I think that even if they haven't conceptualized, like, how rap music can be used as a tool, can be repurposed and then used as a tool to at a minimum expose what the power structure is trying to do to us. Because I think a lot of people, they have more of a traditional approach, whereas, okay, they identify it as something that is harmful and toxic. So the initial response is to isolate yourself from it, or insulate yourself from it. You know, so it's to stay away from it. You know, like, don't play that stuff. Don't turn that stuff on ahead. So, and even as, you know, with all due respect, you know, to my parents, I think that was their approach in the 1980s and the 1990s. Having lived through that experience, when I became a parent, I took a different approach. So the same approach that I use with my own children is an approach that I would use with children, in terms of checking the lyrics and doing the analysis and kind of confronting it head on. So instead of telling my, you know, trying to isolate my son from it, or insulate my son from the music, I want to combat it. I want to, you know, confront it head on, and I want us to analyze and, you know, deconstruct it and say, okay, like, okay, this line right here, when he's saying this, like, you know, why does this make sense? You know, or why, you know, is that the only purpose? What is he trying to imply? Is he trying to teach you that this is the only value of women, and this is what Black women are good for? This is it? This is all they got going for themselves? Right? Is what's in between their legs, or some other activity they might do with their mouth to a part of your anatomy? Like, let's really think about that. Because I think a lot of times, again, if I can make you dance to it, I can make you believe it. We, you know, people dance to the stuff, and then it becomes their own personal narrative. And but I think when you confront it, then you can say, no, that's not true. Again, the false reality. And then when you recognize that it's a false reality, then you can reject it, you know, much more easily. And then also, like, in terms of, like, dealing with my own children, I know they're going to be exposed to it among their friends, you know, when I'm not around. But I want to have already done that work to kind of, what I call it, anesthetize them against it, you know, kind of vaccinate them, I guess, against it. So, like, when one of their friends is, you know, rapping those lyrics, it's like, bro, like, that don't really make sense. Did you ever think about why that doesn't make sense? You know, like, why is that cool? You know what I mean? Like, you know, let's really think about that. But a lot of times, that question is never asked. That simple question among youth, why is that cool? Because the assumption is that it's cool just because it's part of a song by a popular rapper that has been given to them by the mainstream, and they see that as, okay, well, he has made it because he's been validated by the white man, because the white man gave him a record deal, so therefore he must be good, which, again, just reinforces Eurocentrism. It's like, I got to listen to this guy. I got to listen to this Black man or this Black woman because the white man said so. It's kind of like how they give us political candidates. It's like, okay, the Democratic Party gave me this Black man, so therefore I must vote for him. And I don't even have to know nothing about his political platform. I don't got to know nothing about his background. By him being a Democrat is like, you know, by proxy, it's like he's been validated by the white establishment. That's all that matters. The same thing happens with rappers and other entertainers. It's like, okay, I don't got to question nothing he does. All I know is he was good enough for the white man to promote him and give him airplay and give him a record deal. And, you know, he has videos and he drives fancy overpriced cars in the videos and wears jewelry and all these types of things. So therefore he's A1, you know, and the youth are not challenging that and even thinking about, okay, well, you know, should I even accept this? And again, we can't blame them because again, like I made the comparison, I drew the parallel with our political action as well. And adults do the same thing with politicians.
Yeah.
so it's like, we can't get mad at the 13-year-old that likes the rapper and, you know, gives the rapper credibility when his 45-year-old father or whoever does the same thing with a politician.
Yeah.
So it's really intergenerational. It's an intergenerational issue that we suffer from.
I guess we got about 9 minutes left in the program. Before we kind of turn things over to you, Professor Keel, so you can give everybody your contacts and things of that nature, let's go back to a quick question out of Newport News. Let's go back.
Brother Keel, I scanned your Facebook page right quick. I used to do Big Brothers a long time ago, but to get to the question quick. Do you think that raising our children to only put value in look good, feel good, taste good has a lot to do with how easy they're sold on this ruse?
Definitely.
I know. I grew up getting value out of completing tasks, doing things for other people, you know, community, old folks, that kind of thing. I don't see any of that anymore. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, to answer your question, I definitely think that has a lot to do with it, because now we live in a society that promotes kind of these external values, external. The look, you know, kind of like a fake it till you make it society, you know, even in business, you know, in businesses, you know, I was taught years ago in business, I studied business in undergrad, and, you know, it's like, you know, all flash, no cash type thing, but you use the flash to attract people so that maybe you can eventually gain some cash, you know, so that definitely is part and parcel of just the American capitalist society that we exist in, but yeah, just because, you know, you can trick people into thinking that a certain thing is a certain way, and because it does, being superficial doesn't require any analysis. So if something looks good to you and it appeals to your sensibilities and your tastes, then you don't need to analyze it, you know, because it's, you know, people will say, oh, you're doing too much when you start thinking and using your brain. You know, it's like people will say that to you, like, you're doing too much. Well, I think you're not doing enough. And that's how people get schemed. That's how you get hustled, you know, because you can sell somebody a box with nothing in it, but the outside of the box is real shiny. And, you know, people become enamored with the outside of the box and how shiny it is. And then they, you know, buy the box and they get in, and then later on they're mad because they got hustled. You know, but that's the world we live in, and that's the way people are being socialized by these institutions. So, you know, I'm past the point of even trying to necessarily change the institutions that are responsible for this. I'm more at the point of trying to create some alternative institutions that our youth could come to be socialized more properly, namely with schools, you know, public schools, charter schools. Overall, private, parochial, they're giving our children of African descent a heavy dosage of daily Negro assimilationism. You know, they're getting that. So we need to have them, we need to have some other institutions, or even if it's not a whole full-scale institution, just a space that we occupy, a maroon space, so to speak. If we get back into, like, you know, the history of chattel slavery and how we existed and it created the maroon spaces when we left the plantations and escaped into the hinterlands, you know, where they're getting a heavy dosage of revolutionary black nationalism and Pan-African nationalism, when they're getting heavy dosages of that, and then the youth can decide. You know, they can just, you know, they can decide what makes more sense. And some of them, I doubt it, but some might, you know, decide that Negro assimilationism might make more sense to them. But I think a lot of them, a lot of our people go toward, you know, the I guess like a moth to the flame of the light of Negro assimilationism, because that's all they know. And they really think that that's the only alternative, the only option that they have, because they just haven't been taught about anything different. And that's where these people come in, because then, you know, you teach them about the Kwame Ture's, you teach them about, you know, the Huey Newtons, you teach them about the Malcolm X's, you really teach them about the Malcolm X's, like through his speeches and through his like political work and through his analysis, not just the movie. The movie can be a start, but then we have to go deeper with our youth. So then you say, okay, well, these were like, okay, I'm a young black man, young black male. I'm going to be a black man. You know, these were black men. These are exemplars. So now I can, and then, you know, if it's a brother from Detroit, and it's like, okay, well, that's where Malcolm spent a lot of time at, in Michigan, in Lansing or wherever, which if he was from Omaha, Nebraska, and that's really an exemplar. Okay, Malcolm was born there, you know? From Boston, okay, Malcolm spent time in Boston. You know, if you're from Harlem, okay, Malcolm spent a lot of time in Harlem. If you're from Philly, Malcolm spent time in Philly. You know, so, and then, you know, we really kind of introduce people to like the work of young people, to the work of Malcolm and these other people. Then they'll make some different decisions. Our children are very intelligent. I think we underestimate sometimes the media. We kind of get caught up in a lot of the media projections about our youth, and we underestimate their intelligence. But you know, because a lot of times they don't have an opportunity to really show their intelligence in terms of those types of intellectual things.
Elliot, is as we move to a close, and Brother Akil, now Elliot, I might be speaking too fast or putting out there, but because Brother Akil brought up about the Black History Collaborative, mm-hmm. and the project that you're working on now in relation to young people, and I'm listening to them, and I'm saying, okay, this goes into somewhat what we'll be doing soon, possibly, with some young people. So taking his points is like really important in order to create that collaborative and not insult those young people intelligence, but at the same time be able to use that methodology of what's that, exemplary and geography.
Right.
Because they are coming from here, in expressing their views, if I understand it right.
Right. Because we're just meeting them where they are. It's just like, you know, everybody wants to represent their hood. You know, that's really what it comes down to. You know what I'm saying? Like oh, this is my hood. I want to represent my hood, and I want to identify with people that are also from my hood. You know, like, oh, what's the name grew up around here? Like, okay, you feel if this person is seen as successful within the community and within the society, and then you find out, okay, this person was from my hood, now you feel like, okay, I'm connected to that success, right? Mm-hmm. So, but then we give them, you know, these people that they never knew about, and, you know, it's like, for example, like I grew up in Baltimore. I put myself into this. And recently I was reading, an essay in, from the compilation, The Death of White Sociology, edited by Joyce Ladner, right? Shout out to Joyce Ladner, right? And it talked about E. Franklin Frazier. It was the first essay in the book, which kind of does a kind of overview of the history of the development of Black sociology. E. Franklin Frazier, Horace Caton, Robert Park, some other people I'm forgetting. But anyway, it talked about, give a little biographical information on E. Franklin Frazier. I never knew that he was from Baltimore. And I grew up in Baltimore. So now I'm like, okay, like, and I'm already on that wave, though, of identifying with those types of scholars and those type of workers that were, you know, from where I'm from. You know, I already feel, you know, proud because, okay, Douglas spent time in Baltimore. You know, I already feel some, Grand Marshal Eddie Conway from the Black Panther Party, former political prisoner from Baltimore. Like, I already feel some type of way. I already feel a sense of pride because they're from Baltimore and I grew up there. You know, I spent my formative years in Baltimore. So, but recently finding out, okay, E. Franklin Frazier was from Baltimore. Okay, cool. So now I want to study him even more. You know, as more motivation to zero in on that brother and that brother's work, because he was, you know, from there. So I guess a lot of it, like the idea itself, is very personal to me, because just naturally and organically, that's just how I move and how I operate. You know, when I look, I learn about somebody, and I'm like, okay. And if I can identify with them, if I feel any type of connection, I mean, even like Sheikh Antajou, it's not a geographical connection per se. Joke was from Senegal, but when I, at one point, when I found out that Joke was a mathematician, I took a step back and said, okay, I need to take this teacher thing much more seriously. Like, I knew of Joke as a historian and as a, you know, a cultural anthropologist, perhaps, or anthropologist. I didn't know he was a mathematician and a physicist. I didn't know that, but once I found out he's a mathematician, I'm like, oh, wait. So I called myself a math teacher. This man, who was a legend, was a mathematician. So now I got to step my game up, really. And that's just how I move. So this methodology kind of grows out of, you know, just my own personal thing.
Well, before we close things out, Brother Keel, give out any information, how people can reach you, pass up, cool. Anything you want to give.
Yeah, the best way is probably Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. I'm not on Twitter that much, but on Facebook, it's my government name, Akil Parker, A-K-I-L, last name Parker, P-A-R-K-E-R, A-K-I-L, P-A-R-K-E-R. And on Instagram, it's Akil, A-K-I-L, underscore Latif, L-A-T-E-E-F. And Twitter's the same, A-K-I-L, underscore L-A-T-E-E-F. So Akil underscore Latif on Instagram and Twitter, and Akil Parker on Facebook. That's the best way to get in contact with me.
All right. And before I let you go, you know I'm going to be reaching out to you for part two of our discussion about developing a African-centered political agenda here. You know we had that first session.
Right. And I was out of town.
Yeah, you couldn't make it. But
congratulations to my brother, Dr. Gerard Bryson. He got married that weekend, and he thought enough of me to put me in the wedding. So,
but don't worry,
I couldn't attend.
We're gonna let you know about part two, which will be coming up very soon.
Okay, yeah, just let me know the date. I'm definitely interested.
Good, good. Love to have your input, and we'll talk soon, man. Thank you for your work.
All right, thank you for having me. Mm-hmm.
The door is always open, brother.
Okay.
Peace.
Peace.
Richard, interesting conversation as always, yeah, man. you know, that panel that we had, that gives the listening audience a little flavor of some of the other people that were on that panel.
Right.
Sister Stacy Nzinga-Hill, Omar Wiley, Professor Carl Tone Jones, Brother Nkrumah. I mean, that lets the people know some of the folks that we had here, they're not playing. And I can't wait for part two of the discussion to bring Akil in on it.
Great.
Before we leave this evening, I want to let everybody know about the lineup. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening. Later on Monday evening, 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed, and from 8 to 9, Let's Buy Black 365 Connect with Sister Nataki and Brother Talib. On Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for Awakening. On Wednesday, Revive with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. And then Fridays, Time for Awakening is back from 8 to 10. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, you're watching your children playing.
after school. They seem to be so unaware of, I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. And little Mary, she said she got to teach school. If we know all we say we know about the problem. To save the children.